it's, I think, a suitable moment to reflect a little bit on how the notion of openness, the concept of openness, however defined, relates to some of the other panels that have been happening, taking place today. And so issues of government-level qualifications frameworks, issues of accreditation, certification, the role of ICT in all of this is something for us to consider as we hear this particular panel. They don't need any introduction. Our first panelist is Stephen Downs. We've heard from him before, and so I welcome your presentation.
That was very sudden. Thank you very much. I'm going to be much briefer this time. They've told me I have to be. You see the CC, you see the CC logo on my computer. It stands for Creative Commons, and that's a licensing scheme people have been using for, 10 years, more than 10 years now, in order to share resources openly. And in my own work and in my own practice, I've always shared my work openly. In fact, on my website now, I have the slides for my presentation, which I've already created and shared as an open educational resource. And when I get back to the hotel and I can access the secure side of my website, the audio will also be available. And so I will have created, out of our activity today, a learning resource. This is the model, very much the model that we used when we created, George Siemens and I and Dave Cornier and a host of other people, the first massive open online course. And just to get the numbers correct on the record, it happened in 2008. George Siemens and I created a course in order to demonstrate the connectivist approach to education, and I talked a bit about that this morning. And we figured the best way to do that was to put a course online that instantiated connectivist learning principles. That's a diagram of the course. That's a diagram of the course on day one. Of course, it grew tremendously during the 13 or so weeks that we offered it. What you should notice about that is that it's not a nice linear progression like a textbook or a typical course. It's a network. It's an environment. And the idea here is that participants can move around that network and can share resources back and forth with each other in the network. We set it up that way expecting maybe 24 people to join the course because it was about connectivism, the very narrow topic. We got 2,200 people, which surprised us and really was an accident. But because we had structured the course that way, it actually worked better with 2,200 people. And people contributed resources. They found resources all over the internet, contributed them, created a discussion, created a community that lasted after the course and resulted in the worldwide phenomenon that you know of as MOOCs. In this short, very short presentation, I want to talk about the thinking behind that. Why would we use open educational resources? Why not just use textbooks or licensed videos or something like that? I want to change your way of thinking about open educational resources. Stop thinking of them like textbooks. Stop thinking about them like lessons or parts of a traditional course. This is connectivism. It's a conversation. It's an interaction. And each individual open educational resource is like a word in that conversation. And the participants in the course and the instructors in the course use these words to communicate back and forth with each other. There are all kinds of examples of that on the internet. We can even think of this, which is a word cloud, which is a resource made up of words, which is kind of interesting. And it's a way of, in a non-syntactical way, representing a point or an idea. I used to, and I still do, make what are called lolcats, and a lolcat is a picture of a cat, yes, a cat, with a funny slogan on it. So I make the picture, I put the slogan on it, and then I share it with all my friends, and everybody laughs at my lolcat. It's a word. It's a way of having a conversation with people using multimedia words and not just text-based words. The idea here is that this is the way we create knowledge. We create knowledge initially by communicating with each other using whatever words, whatever dialogue we have. And it's only later on that it becomes, as they say, reified. It's only later on that we make it more concrete and more structured. But in the beginning, in the conversation, it's very loose, it's very flexible, it's very informal, it flows. And as it flows in the conversation, eventually it settles and becomes stable. We try to get people to remember the stuff that's settled and stable, but the important part is they participate in the flow that creates knowledge. The idea here now is that it's not simply the educator or the educational institution creating open educational resources. What we deliberately set out to do was to have our users, our students, our learners, generate the open educational resources themselves. This was something that distinguished what we did from the large-scale MOOCs from Stanford and Harvard, etc., that followed. They just had their own instructors create a bunch of content. It was very powerful, very effective, but it's even more powerful and more effective when the people who are learning themselves create their own learning resources. And remember, they're not just working by themselves, they're working in this network. And it's not just the creation of the resource, the sharing of the resource is crucial. If you want to say something in a sentence with words, you can create your sentence, but your sentence does not acquire any meaning until it is spoken aloud and shared with everyone else. That's when the learning happens. We sometimes talk about this as working out loud. I'm, in my other life, a philosopher. I have different lives. And part of what I do as a philosopher is I do my thinking about philosophy out loud. I make lots of mistakes, lots of false starts. My philosophical thinking is by no means perfect, but I give people, students, other philosophers, an opportunity to see what it's like to think as a philosopher. And then as they interact with me, they themselves become able to think as a philosopher, and they acquire that capacity themselves. But it begins with working out loud. If I just stay in my office and do nothing but produce a nice polished paper every 6 months, nobody would ever know how that was done. Nobody would ever learn the process to create that sort of knowledge. And we translate this into practice in a very practical way by taking our lives, our work as educators, or as philosophers, or as doctors, or as engineers, and turning them into open educational resources. We model this practice for our students. And that's what I'm attempting to do with my work as an educator. You go to my website, which you saw in the earlier presentation. You see the talks that I've given. You see the articles that I've written. You see all of the mistakes. You get to hear me mispronounce Etienne Wenger's name consistently through a presentation, because that happens. And when you see the human side of being a philosopher, it means you are more able to be a philosopher. So here's where we end up. Here is where we finish this part of the discussion. If you look on the internet, look beyond the colleges, beyond the universities, look well beyond and outside the learning management system into the communities that I talked about earlier on this morning, and we see Stack Overflow, a community for computer programmers, WebMD, a community of people who want to know about medicine, DeviantArt, which is a community for graphic artists, Ask the Builder for construction and carpentry, and one of my favorites, Vegan Black Metal Chef, a person who creates vegan recipes to the sound of very loud music. Wonderful stuff. That's all I have to say, but I'm sure we'll continue the discussion.
Thank you, Stephen. Our next speaker is Dr. Mohammed Jemmi of Alexo, Tunisia.
Showing.
There you go. Okay. Okay. I have to answer it.
Do you want a mouse?
No, it's okay. Okay. But I haven't in the screen. I haven't the presentation.
Oh, I see.
Do we need assistance?
Yeah, he needs to set his display to duplicate. Option graphics. No, it's not it.
Broken. There you go. Is he good?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Then.
It's fine.
Yes. Then, في نفس سياق المداخلة المتميزة لستيفن دويس سأتكلم على مشروع الأليكسو لتعزيز التعليم المفتوح والتعليم الإلكتروني في الوطن العربي باستخدام الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة والتعليم الإلكتروني العالي الاستقطاب. إذن كنت تكلمت الصبح عن تكلمت الصبح عن بعض مشاريع المنظمة العربية للتربية والثقافة والعلوم في ظل التطور الرهيب للتكنولوجيا الرقمية والتي وضعت بصماتها على التعليم وخاصة أنتجت فرص وإمكانيات جديدة. ومن ضمن هذه الإمكانيات هو ما يسمى الآن بالتعلم المفتوح وما أنتج من موارد رقمية مفتوحة الآن أصبحت مشاعة على الإنترنت، وأنماط جديدة من التعليم الإلكتروني المفتوح أو ما يسمى بالتعليم الإلكتروني العالي الاستقطاب أو ما يسمى أيضا بالموكس. لذلك أود يعني في نفس سياق مثل ما المتدخل السابق ستيفن دويس أقدم بعض المفاهيم حول ما يسمى بالأوير أو الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة. طبعا الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة أول ما ظهرت في عن طريق اليونسكو 2002، ثم هناك مؤتمر باريس 2012 كذلك هو مؤتمر اليونسكو، وهو الذي شكل نقطة محورية ونقطة فاصلة وتحول كبير، حيث المصطلح وقع الاتفاق على مصطلح الأوير أو الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة. وطبعا من أهم مميزات الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة أو ما يسمى بالأوير هو أولا هذه موارد موجودة مشاعة على الإنترنت، طبعا يمكن أن تكون بدون مقابل، ولكن الأهم شيء هو أنه يمكن للشخص أن يأخذ تلك الموارد، أن يغيرها، يطوحها، مثلا إذا كان معلم أو أستاذ يمكن أن يطوحها حسب حاجياته البيداغوجية، يمكن أن ينشرها، يمكن أن يدمج العديد من الموارد حتى يصنع موارد جديدة. هذه النقلة هي نقلة كبيرة، لأنه طبعا نحن نعرف كنا نستعمل من الإنترنت، ولكن الآن هناك حتى حقوق ملكية محترمة، وسنأتي على هذه الحقوق الملكية التي تمكن من احترام الملكية الفكرية، أشار لها ستيفن دويس ولكن سأأتي عليها بأكثر تفاصيل. ولكن أنا حسب رأيي التغيير الكبير هو إمكانية الامتلاك، ولكن إمكانية التغيير وإمكانية النشر والامتلاك. يعني ننطلق من نسخة أصلية من الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة، ولكن نستطيع أن نطوحها ونغيرها حسب حاجياتنا البيداغوجية وحسب حاجياتنا التعليمية، وهذا هو التطور الكبير الذي صار في الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة. طبعا هذه الموارد الآن هي موجودة على الإنترنت، وموجودة خاصة في ما يسمى ببنوك للموارد التعليمية المفتوحة أو ما يسمى بالـ OER Repositories. هذا على الشاشة تجدون بعض من هذه النماذج، بعض من هذه البنوك الكبرى التي تتيح أولا هذه البنوك للموارد التعليمية المفتوحة لإيواء الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة حتى يكون هناك مكان أو فضاء مخصص لتلك الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة، أولا لأخذ تلك الموارد أو لإيواء تلك الموارد. وطبعا مثل ما قلت منذ سنة 2012 ويعني بعد مؤتمر اليونسكو 2012 أصبحت هناك معايير، أصبحت هناك ستاندرز، أصبح هناك ما يسمى بالميتا داتا حتى تسهل عملية النشر وما يسمى بالاندكساسيون، حتى تكون تلك الموارد المفتوحة سهلة الوصول، وحتى تكون يعني يمكن الوصول إليها. الاندكسينج of this material is very important. طبعا الحقوق الآن الكرياتيف كومنز لايسنسينج هي يعني تنظم، هي الكرياتيف كومنز هي منظمة، it's non-profit، هي NGO، وأصدرت هذه الحقوق والتي تعطي يعني 6 درجات مثل ما تشاهدون هنا في الأسفل، هو يعني أقل حقوق من تعطي يعني أقل حرية في التصرف، حتى الفوق يعني السادس هو أكبر قدر من الحرية. يعني تجدون تلك العلامات مثلا باي، هذا يعني الشرط عند الكرياتيف كامل لايسنسنج أنه تقدر أنك تنشر، تقدر أنك تغير، تقدر أن تمتلك، تقدر أن تستعملها لهدف تجاري، ولكن الشرط الوحيد هو يجب التنصيص على المالك الأصلي لتلك الأوير. يعني باي يجب أن تذكر من أو تلك يعني الريسورسز من الذي اشتغلها. بالطبع في SA يعني سيل إيكوال النون كوميرشال، وهكذا يعني شفتم يعني من تحت إلى فوق هكذا
كل ما نسعد كل ما نعطي أكثر حرية للتصرف في تلك الموارد الرحمية. ولكن دائما في الست درجات هناك دائما يجب التنصيص على المالك الأصلي. نحن مشروعنا في المشروع الأليكسو هو كذلك أولا من ناحية في الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة هو هدفنا. ونحن الآن بصدد الشغل وحتى يعني عندنا مشروع تعاون مع يونسكو باريس. أولا يعني على جانبين، الجانب الأول هو لابد من تبني سياسة وطنية في كل دولة عربية للتشجيع وللنهوض بقطاع الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة. يعني لا يجب ولا يكفي أن يكون مجموعة من المدرسين أو من الباحثين، ولكن يجب أن تكون وراء ذلك يعني غاية سياسية وعزيمة سياسية وتوجه سياسي من الوزارة المعنية. التشجيع على الموارد التعليمية المفتوحة وهو نوع من إتاحة التعليم للجميع، نوع من أنواع ترشيد الأنفاق. ثم نحن أنا أعطيت يعني بعض أمثلة للبنوك المعطيات أو الريبوزيتوري. الاتحاد الأوروبي ضخ ملايين اليوروات حتى ينتج بنوك لهذه الموارد لاستعمالها بصفة مشتركة في أوروبا أو في أمريكا الشمالية. ونحن في دولنا العربية مع الأسف ما زالت ليست هناك أي مبادرة ما عدا المبادرة الأولى للأليكسو، وهو الهدف هو يعني إحداث منصة للعمل التشاركي لهذه الموارد. نحن 22 دولة عربية نتكلم نفس اللغة، لنا نفس الحضارة، نفس التاريخ، وليس معناها من الأجدى وحتى من باب الترشيد في الأنفاق يعني عوض أن كل دولة عربية تطور نفس المحتويات. نستطيع أن عن طريق التشارك وعن طريق هذه المنصة المشتركة أن كل دولة تبني وتطور بعض المحتويات ثم تستعملها بصفة مشتركة مع الدول الأخرى، وهكذا ننمي حجم هذه المنصة وتكون أكثر يعني تأثيث بالموارد ويكون الاستعمال مشترك بين الدول العربية. نحن إذن نشتغل على هذه المنصة ثم نشتغل على بناء سياسات، وهذا كما قلت هو مشروع تعاون مع اليونسكو. عندنا اليونسكو حقيقة يونسكو باريس عندها خطة ونحن اشتغلنا معها اوريدي، يعني عملنا ورشة أولى في تونس مع 7 دول عربية وسنعمم البرنامج على كل الدول العربية لكيف نبني سياسة وطنية للنهوض بهذا القطاع. هناك طبعا استراتيجية، هناك توعية، هناك تدريب، يعني كيف ننتج موارد تعليمية ذات جودة، ما هي الميتاداتا اللي يجب أن عند تطوير الموارد التعليمية يجب يعني القيام وإنجازها حتى تصبح سهلة الوصول وحتى أن محركات البحث تصل إليها بسرعة. إذن هذا المشروع الأول. ثم الآن المشروع الثاني هو مشروع الموكس. طبعا هذا يعني بعض منصات. نحن في الحقيقة وهذا كذلك خيار استراتيجي سنشتغل مع منصة رواق، وهي منصة أنتجتها مؤسسة سعودية، يعني شباب سعودي مبدع أنجوا هذه المنصة. هذه المنصة عمرها 3 سنوات الآن، ولكن هم احتفلوا بأكثر من مليون يعني منتسب لتلك المنصة، أكثر من مليون شخص درس تلك المنصة. الآن منصة رواق موجودة في العشر في التوب 10 منصات حول العالم. احنا انجزنا اتفاقية منذ نشأتها منذ 2014 ونحن الان بصدد الاعداد لانجاز اول موك سنطلقه ان شاء الله قريبا في منتصف شهر ديسمبر حول تطوير تطبيقات الجوالة. هو في الحقيقة انطلاق من مشروع اللي قد حكيت عليه هذا الصباح. قمنا في اطار مشروع المطورين الشبان بانجاز مشروع تدريبي ل 500 شاب وشابة تونسية عن طريق ما يسمى سبوك. هو في الحقيقة التدريب احنا اخذنا لمدة 6 اشهر 500 شاب وشابة تونسية، قسمناهم على 20 فريق، كل فريق فيه 25 طالب او طالبة، نغطي كل الجمهورية. والتدريب هو في حد ذاته تدريب يعني غير مسبوق، تدريب يعني نموذجي بامتياز. هو تدريب يراوح بين التدريب الحضوري. احنا اولا 20 فريق عملنا تدريب مدربين ثم تدريب حضوري لخمس أيام. بعد الخمس أيام للطلبة هناك شهرين يدرسون عن طريق الموك أو في الحقيقة هو سبوك يعني Small Private Open Course لأنه مغلق ل 500 طالب. ثم بعد الموك نعطيهم فكرة نعطيهم شهر حتى يفكروا في فكرة لإنجاز تطبيقات ثم نعطيهم شهرين لإنجاز تطبيقاتهم. نحن الآن في المرحلة الأخيرة والطلبة حتى 20 نوفمبر سيقدمون تطبيقاتهم وفي نهاية الشهر أو في بداية ديسمبر سنقيم حفل اختتام هذا المشروع النموذجي ثم سنحاول أن نعممه بعد التجربة النموذجية سنعممه في كل الدول العربية وكذلك الموارد والمضامين والفيديوهات والموك اللي اشتغلنا فيه عن طريق في شكل سبوك الآن سيصبح في شكل موك. طبعا هذه المراحل اللي قدمتها ولكن ممكن يعني نعطيكم بعض النماذج من الفيديوهات ومن الموك اللي اشتغلنا عليه. أرجع أنه يشتغل. وفي الحقيقة طبعا هذا التدريب في المشروع النموذجي هذا هو التدريب كان باللغة الفرنسية ولكن اشتغلنا على ثلاث لغات. الآن المحتوى سيكون متوفر في اللغة باللغة العربية واللغة الفرنسية واللغة الإنجليزية. عفوا خليني أعطيك. سيكون في ثلاث لغات وهذا ممكن أن نقول هو أول موك في الحقيقة عربي 100% سواء من ناحية المنصة أو من ناحية المحتوى. نعطيكم نموذج صغير حتى تشوفوا يعني المقاطع الفيديو كيفية إنجازها. ننتظر شوي حتى يأتي الفيديو. طبعا دروس الموك هي دائما تعتمد اولا على مقطع فيديو الاستاذ يقدم الدرس ثم هناك محتويات تعليميه وهناك انشطه بيداغوجيه يجب ان يقوم بها الطالب هناك تمارين هناك بعض المشاريع ثم في نهايه الدرس هناك ما يسمى بالباتش وطبعا حتى يتحصل على هو الاعتراف بانهاء الموك يجب ان يحصل كل الباجيت يعني في كل شابتر هناك بادج عندما يتحصل على كل بادجيت يأخذ شهادة إنهاء الدرس. هذا مثلا المقطع
jQuery Mobile est une bibliothèque JavaScript permettant de créer des pages web avec un design qui s'adapte parfaitement à toutes les plateformes mobiles. Elle est construite au-dessus de la bibliothèque jQuery, sa version actuelle est jQuery Mobile 1.4. jQuery Mobile s'appuie sur HTML5, CSS3 et JavaScript. C'est une bibliothèque stable et utilisée par des milliers de développeurs à travers le monde. jQuery Mobile offre plus d'abstraction avec son API de haut niveau par rapport à HTML et JavaScript, et donc il simplifie beaucoup le développement des applications. C'est une bibliothèque JavaScript et donc évidemment, elle adopte le principe de programmation événementielle. Ainsi, on peut modifier les éléments d'un suite aux événements déclenchés par l'utilisateur.
طبعا هناك استثمار في صناعة الفيديو حتى يكون يعني الفيديو ذا جودة عالية ومثل ما شفتوا يعني استعنا بشركة لإنتاج الفيديو حتى تقوم بعملية المونتاج وعملية الدمج الصور والحركية والأنيميشن حتى يعطي هذه الفيديوهات وهذه المقاطع ذات الجودة العالية بهذه الطريقة. إذن نظن أن استهلكت الوقت. إذن مثل ما قلت إن شاء الله يعني هذا الدرس سيكون مفتوح للعموم ومن المنتظر أن يكون في منتصف ديسمبر إن شاء الله سنطلق في العالم العربي كله ونتصور ونتوقع أنه آلاف الطلبة من كل الوطن العربي أنهم سيتابعون هذا الدرس وعلى هذه المنصة وشكرا جزيلا.
Our third speaker is Dr. Walid Kara of Balamand University in North Lebanon.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity I was given to present a topic related to education, higher education. I'm going to talk about NRENs. Anybody knows what an NREN is here? Before I start the discussions, what is an NREN? Okay, great. So that's a topic that everybody in higher education, I assume, knows. But I'm going to briefly discuss the concepts and then move on to what we're actually doing here in Lebanon in this regard. Okay, so National Education and Research Networks, NRENs. So what is an NREN, for those who don't know yet? An NREN, that's believe it or not, it's a specialized ISP. But it's an ISP, it's an internet service provider dedicated to supporting the needs of research and education communities within a certain country. It's a high-speed, very high-speed backbone network. Typically, we're talking in Europe, for instance, talking 100 gigabit per second. The NREN typically has dedicated channels for individual research projects among universities. The architectures that we're talking about on these networks are typically cloud-based today, more modern cloud technology, but also client and server technologies. So the question here is, why NRENs? And the big question is, why the internet isn't enough? Every university today is connected with the internet with a high capacity, but isn't that enough? Probably not. Dedicated networks, because we need fast and efficient state-of-the-art network, services, tools, applications to boost research and productivity. Minimize the costs and leverage economies of scale by available research, by using available research, academic and technical resources. We're talking about here economies of scale among universities using same resources, sharing their own resources. Growing demand for high performance computing. And if for instance, a university in Lebanon needs those resources which are not available on campus, they could use a resource available in Europe, or in the US, or in Japan. Create a common culture of research and education community, among research and education communities. And collaborate on research projects. Typically, universities today, especially in the Middle East, are isolated islands with specific research projects. So creating this culture of cooperation, collaboration, and sharing is very important. The purpose of an NREN basically is to bring researchers, educators, and academics together, not only in the same campus, but across campuses, to accelerate science, these are global titles, to drive innovation and to enrich education. The structure of an NREN in a country might look like this as a topology. You're not going to change your internal network of a campus. Every campus would still have its own security and environment, but you would connect to a regional network in your country, and the regional network would connect to a national network. The national network would be called the NREN, and then the NREN would connect to another NREN across the continents or across regions. I'm talking about various projects available in the world today. For instance, the GEONT project. Anybody is familiar with GEONT here? The GEONT project of Europe. This is the large set of NRENs in Europe. I will talk about GEONT in a minute. Internet 2 in the US, for instance. The EU Med Connect 3 project, which I will talk also about briefly, which is a project by the European Commission to support Mediterranean countries to build their own NRENs. And the examples are numerous. Some of them are here for like Red Clara and South in Latin America, and Kibbutz in the UAB, Canary in Canada, and et cetera, et cetera. ASRAN actually is the Arab State Research and Education Network. This is a topology of the Giant network, where each one of the points on this network is actually an end ring of a certain country, and they're all interconnected. And the capacities are huge. We're talking about, as I mentioned, somewhere between 10 gigabit per second and 100 gigabit per second, sometimes more. So the Giant interconnects Europe and Rennes. You have, Giant has 10,000 institutions across Europe, 50 million users on that network, and over 1,000 terabytes being circulated over the network per day. So this is a huge number. Imagine this will move to the internet, the current internet that we know today. This will probably bring it down. The Giant Pan-European network is connected to all other networks in the world via undersea cables. There's a lot of investment here. And let me talk about the EU MedConnect 3 project, which is actually a project created by the European Commission to support Middle Eastern countries. So it has a partnership with ASRAN, which I will also describe, the Arab State Network. So it supports connections basically today. It has budget for Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine. In fact, unfortunately, Palestine has not received any funds yet, and Lebanon is eligible as well as Jordan. It has a lot of synergies with Africa Connect 2 project, which is also another EU project to connect the African countries, the Northern African country. It has committed over 3 million euros until 2017, so the project is still going on. There are prospects of extending it as well. 3 million euros is not a large amount, but at least it's an incentive for those countries to start the projects and to connect. ASRAN, with which we cooperate, is the was established under the umbrella of the League of Arab States, so it's an official organization, actually today run by the Talal Abu Ghazali organization in Jordan. It implements, manages, and extends sustainable pan-Arab infrastructures for research and education. It connects Arab institutions among themselves and to the globe through high-speed data communications networks. So supposedly ASRAN is responsible for promoting the creation of NRENs in various countries like Lebanon and Jordan, already have done, and like in Egypt and across all 22 Arab countries. The ASRAN network looks, the topology looks like that, and there's two main POPs that connect the Arab world to the internet, one in London and one in Egypt. Actually, there's one in Fujairah as well that connects to the eastern side of. How about us in Lebanon? What we're doing is we have created recently the Lebanese Education and Research Network, which we are calling LEARN. This network has 11 founding members today, including all 10 major universities of the country, the largest ones, and also in addition to the CNRS, National Council for Scientific Research. So 11 members are actively involved in creating this network today. The objectives of LEARN is to create high-speed digital communications infrastructure among educational institutions, hopefully a gigabit network for research and education in Lebanon. It's not a gigabit yet, but anyway, this is the plan. Products and services on top, regional and international collaborations. We already have MOUs with ASRAN and Giant, negotiating with Internet too, to create common culture among universities. This is important in Lebanon because traditionally Lebanese universities compete to recruit students, compete to create new programs. That's not bad, but it's always like we're better than that. Look what we're doing. They're not doing it. So this culture of competition may become negative. We're trying to create a different culture. We're And actually, we have succeeded in bringing IT people, IT so far only, IT people together in a consortium where we discuss all common interests and common projects, and we're bringing in researchers also. Shared technology services and resources. We already have deployed, for instance, EDU ROM across our campuses. We're cooperating on that. Shaping legislation to support use of technology, use and create a network itself. Actually, we're trying to lobby with legislators and the government to waive the fees of high-speed internet connectivity and high-speed backbones among universities. So what are we offering our academic and research communities? There's a lot of services there, hundreds of services, but I will talk about our vision in this regard. The first vision is probably high bandwidth, high-speed international connectivity. Today we only have 300 megabit per second, but we plan to go higher. So we want our students using those high-speed bandwidths, our students, in, for example, in Beirut, to follow a lecture and interact with a speaker in Boston. So these are just examples. We want a researcher at the Lebanese University, for instance, to connect her image processing engine to an HPC in Japan, high-performance computing. We want surgeons at St. George Hospital to engage in live telemedicine applications with surgeons in Paris, for instance. We want a physicist at NDU to connect to CERN data center and probe the fundamental structure of the universe. So these would not be possible to do live demonstrations and experiments without high-speed connectivity. We want a student to connect from his dorm room at U of B and be the next Mark Zuckerberg. Why not? EDROM, I mentioned, it has already been deployed on about 7 or 8 campuses so far, but it's progressing, it's coming to all campuses. Other of hundreds of services that we plan to provide, just like other MNs in Europe and the US, are also listed here: security services, connectivity, authentication, hosting, computing, libraries, etc. Now, the big question here comes down to the sustainability of this project. Who's going to support it? Obviously, we have plans for membership fees. Each university would pay a certain amount, $2,000, $3,000, whatever we agree upon. Government funds, very essential as well. Research and project funding through the EC, the USAID, through, UNESCO, others. Partnership with ASEAN, that's very essential for us as well. EU MedConnect 3, we already have funds from them. UN bodies, the World Bank, other foundations, donations definitely, and probably we might offer consultancy services and for a fee as well. We are shifting our focus from managing infrastructures in our universities to doing research and designing the future of education. That's our goal, I hope, back to the future. We are opening up our campus environment and tearing down walls. We don't want to be in a well-regarded university anymore. We want to be in one global university. We want to be in a connected environment. Thank you.
Thank you for that very interesting presentation. Last but not least, Dr. Abdul Munim Osman of UNESCO Beirut. The floor is yours.
Thank you. First, I would like to apologize that I'm not having a PowerPoint presentation, but it will be included in the USB, which you will have. We have a technical problem with that. And secondly, I would like to say that my presentation is rather a reflection, a reporting, and introduction. Reflection on the usage and prospect of EMIS, which stands for Education Management Information System in Higher Education. And reporting on an experience of UNESCO in a project in Sudan for Image for Higher Education, which is still in the making, and introducing the possibility for countries to utilize UNESCO work in this area, and I will explain to you why. As we know, ICT is used in teaching and learning. This is, I think, most of the presentation today were on this aspect. But on usage of ICT in planning, in management, decision making, and administration is still not recognized or not utilized, actually, in our countries. And if we look to exactly what's going on, the experiences of most of the countries in the region, mostly the Gulf countries, were with commercial companies and maybe some international organizations like World Bank, UNDP, where these Gulf countries set projects with commercial countries in order to create what they are looking for as e-government, that is to have a system for information and also system where citizens can communicate and have their, to have communication with ministries and to process whatever they want from these ministries. Most of the Gulf government spend millions of dollars to create the Image for Higher Education. But what happened, most of these, and I know experience of four countries, did not take off because simply in the beginning, the commercial companies raise the expectation that this system will solve all your problems and so on. And then after installation of the software and the hardware, then they will realize after a time that there is new development taking place in the software and in the hardware, so they have to upgrade that and so on. And in the end, nothing has been achieved. And most of them, they have, equipments which remain obsolete, all software and training has been done and not being utilized. UNESCO prepared a document for a project in Sudan and then negotiated with a number of European and Japan for Sudan to establish an image for Sudan and not using commercially made software program, but use open source system. And UNESCO made an agreement with the group which made that system. Of course, open source systems, they have their own problems, but the thing is, they prove that if there is commitment from all those users, the system can serve all the interests and the countries can make use of a resource which is free, which is devolving and could be incorporated at each stage of development in the system. Like, it will never be obsolete, but it will grow and improve and so on. But in Sudan, we started with what we call need assessment that we get from the Ministry of Higher Education, from a number of institutions. We made the need assessment at two levels, macro level and micro level. Micro level for the whole system, for the ministry and its department, admission office, financing department, planning department, and so on and so forth, the statistics department, and what they really need and what the resources they have. And then at micro level, in 26 universities, because there's about 75 government universities, and there is a number of 40 something, I think, as a private and universities and colleges. So at the beginning, again, I think it began with 26 of these new universities to identify the needs at each university or each institute of education, what is teams could be utilized for, and what's the needs, what is available, and so available in terms of equipment, in terms of the number of cardio, in terms of the usages, in terms of size of the institution, and so on and so forth. So this has been done. The second stage is the training of the trainers, and this IIEP, International Institute of Education Planning in Paris, which is a specialized institution of UNESCO in education planning and higher education, have modules for training trainers and training those who will be involved in administering and running the system of IMIS. And of course, IIEP, because it's a special institution of UNESCO, it charged maybe about $40,000 for running a course, but we managed for to convince Sudanese and IIEP that to have a special kind of training to be done for the trainers, and those trainers will then do the training in Sudan. So if you don't need to have the IIEP coming to Sudan to train all the institutions or the trainers in this institution, but you can train about 5-6, and then those 6 and 5 can train trainers, and those trainers train, you know, the rest. And then after that, there is the installation and the development of the system. We believe, I think we had some problems with delays in the ministry and for the funding and so on. But I believe it is a very promising experience, and I see if the rest of our countries can benefit from this experience, I think it will be at least at university level, if you can convince their ministries, I think that will be a good thing for the region, because the system is cheap and it is promising. Of course, there are problems, but this could be solved and so on. And that is all I can say about my people. Thank you.
Thank you to all. The floor is open for Q&A. Perhaps while we think about our questions, we can begin to have a little discussion here. Thinking back about the different panels that were held today, and maybe going back to what Dr. Gedeon posed as a beginning problematic for us during these 2 days, which is the matter of definitions. And since this is a panel about open and openness and different types of openings, perhaps we can discuss a little bit what exactly we mean by open, what exactly we mean by OER, what are differences between an open educational resource versus open systems versus open access versus open education. I know the literature on the subject is proliferating even as we speak, and perhaps we are in phase two of what it means to be open, but maybe that's a problematic that needs addressing at this time. I think I see a question or a comment over here.
It's both a comment and a question. Because I think in 2 weeks' time, probably with Dr. Pierre Chedon, we will be in Amman for another workshop that is organized by UNESCO Cairo. And initially, they called their workshop Open Textbooks. Yeah? And I was a little bit confused about what is this about, and then we started thinking of, and actually initially the whole discussion was going all over the place, but looking mostly into higher education, but then translating also for primary, secondary. And then this made me think about, okay, while the idea of open education resources is appealing also for primary, secondary, we have still to consider that the situation is quite different as compared to higher education. So and I think this would help us to understand better, because for textbooks, we know the ministry, they have special policies, quality control, they are quite restrictive with regard to choices, so and even for additional education resources, it's a whole story with regard to how open you can be. So if you can maybe elaborate more on this issue of openness as against intellectual property and quality control, because it would be interesting for schools to have to choose from open resources, pool of resources, but I don't know in practice how this can function, especially in the context of Arab states.
And also I have a question. To prepare the translation of the word MOOC, because we have a lot of definition and translations proposed at the Arab world. I remember that you have a presentation where you define MOOC, saying massive is massive by design and not massive by the number. Mm-hmm. Because on the web, we have a lot of slides saying MOOC, and it means by 10, by 1,000, by etc. But I think your approach to massive is massive by design. It's a design and not the number. For this, if you explain for us also this term, it will give us maybe more facilities to translate it for later.
And maybe we can have one more question and then we can address all three questions together. You want to start?
Sure. Okay. Let me begin with massive by design. I do want to come back to the other subject, but I can offer some clarity, I think. When I say massive by design, what I mean is establishing a structure for a course such that if it had 2,000, 10,000, 100,000 students, it would still work, right? It might not have that many, but if it did, it would still work. And when we think of it that way, what this means is we have to limit and indeed eliminate what might be called the bottlenecks, the things that make it not possible to deal with 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 people. I'll give you a quick example. Marking essays. Anyone who's taught in higher education has marked assignments or essays. When I was teaching, I would calculate the amount of marking I had by the linear foot. And I'd go through a foot of marking in an evening. And that represented about 100 students. If I had 1,000 students, I'd be looking at 10 feet of marking, and it would not be possible. So a design that requires marking essays cannot be part of a massive open online course. So what we did, you know, one of the major functions that takes place in an online course, and we haven't really talked about it so far, is the interaction that happens between the professor and the student. And there's tons of literature on that. Everything from Moore to transactional distance to Anderson and Garrison talking about presence. It turns out that having a human being on the other side is really important for all kinds of reasons. But if you make that the same human being every time, if you make that the professor, for example, then you've got something that you cannot do for 1,000 people because that poor person would not have any time to do anything else. Gerard Michel talked yesterday about the model, or earlier today, the model with the professor and the tutors, and that's the way traditional distance education universities attempted to do this. And Open University has done that very well. But still, it's only a one directional interaction. And you saw in his model the flow from the professor to the tutors to the students. So our MOOCs addressed the question of that interaction by encouraging and indeed making it a part of the course that individual participants in the course would find materials, organize instruction, and communicate with each other. And so when we got 2,000 people, we could have all of these different people, all of these different interactions happening, and the course retained its same flavor. I want to talk very briefly about textbooks in that. Open educational resources actually has a history, and it stretches beyond the history of the, you know, the original declarations. And that history is in a technology called learning objects. And the idea of a learning object was that it was a small piece of digital content that could be reused in different environments. And what you would do as a professor is you would take a number of these digital objects, these learning objects, and assemble them together in a sequence or in a learning design in order to create a course. And so the structures and the requirements for open textbooks and e-textbooks generally came from two directions. The first direction was in the quality of the learning object. And we had projects like Merlot, for example, where every learning object was reviewed. Of course, that created one of these scale issues that I just talked about. It turns out that you can't just have a single review board review learning objects. It has to be a whole community reviewing learning objects. But, you know, we're getting to that point. The other side of it is curriculum, right? If we know we have good learning objects, we still need to know we have the right learning objects. And so textbooks are designed according to a national, or in Canada, a provincial curriculum, and then it becomes a task of matching the learning object to the curriculum. There are different ways of doing that. Learning objects had their own metadata. There were different taxonomies. Today, and we'll get to this tomorrow in some of the discussions, this task is being attempted, I won't say accomplished, but attempted by competencies. And so the idea is that you have a competency that runs through a common thread from the curriculum to the learning object to the course itself or the textbook, and then ultimately the method of evaluation. So you evaluate as well. And so it all kind of strings together. The competency is intended to be that glue. So finally, you get what Jim Davis of University of Southern Queensland called a logic model for openness in education. And yes, I had that in the back of my mind when I was doing the presentation this morning. So you have open curriculum. You have open learning objects, which we now think of as open educational resources. You have open textbooks, which is a way of structuring these together. Or you have open learning design, which are different models or patterns of creating learning activities or learning sequences using learning objects. You can also have open assessment, which is the next stage. And that's kind of where Jim Davis's logic model ends, because he has closed certification. But the rest of the world has adopted types of open certification, for example, open badges or open credentials that are verified by different mechanisms. And you can have open competency network. And then all of that is joined together by open source technology and open content licensing at the different levels. So that's probably the way to think, at least, of the openness sequence. Each stage of the educational process can, in one way or another, be thought of as an open kind of resource or an open process. I hope that helps.
Are there any other questions, or would anybody like to make a comment? Maybe I can add a comment, or maybe it's a question. I'm not sure, because I'm still not hearing the definition that I'm searching for in the term open. And maybe it's like those nebulous subjects like quality or beauty or something of the sort that is ineffable. But it sounds to me that very often those of us who are on the ground as educators get caught up in the need to drive down costs. For example, does the sex appeal of open textbooks or textbook repositories online, which I'm not sure are open in the sense that the only difference seems to be one of cost and the medium of delivery. One is print and one is virtual or digital. And of course, this is part and parcel of the problem as open educational resources was articulated in 2002 by UNESCO, and then rehashed in 2012 as a definition in the Paris Declaration. The focus was on the materiality, it seems like to me, of the openness. And now it seems that we're talking more about the value of the experience, the constructivist approach to having students create their own learning resources and their own learning journeys, if you will. And so I wonder to what degree that has to factor in all of these discussions that we're having. Free sounds to me that is as much about cost, and that's a great value in and of itself, and I think it should be that way. But it's also about free as in freedom, as in the philosophical notion that's been debated. I know you brought up Wittgenstein this morning, but there are other great philosophers who talked about freedom and what that means. And so, I don't know, maybe we can nudge the discussion a little bit in that direction as well.
I would like to make some comments. Of course, Stephen gave a lot of details about OER, so in the past and in the future. But I think another aspect that the use and the quality of OER depends of two levels or two aspects. First, in OER, there is a lot of freedom for teacher, for OER designer and creators. And the first or the main criteria of success is the adoption of people and user of this OER produced by someone. Because we cannot avoid to have very different OER in terms of quality. There is a lot of freedom here. Of course, there is a lot of freedom when we talk about individual initiatives.
No one can avoid or can omit a teacher to create his OERs and to publish them in his website. But it's if this OER is is not good and is bad quality, so cannot be successful, and nobody will use his OER. But if he creates a very good quality, so many people will adopt and will use and will reuse and rediffuse, and this make this can be very successful. And the second aspect, when we talk about national project, and this is very important to build national strategies, and it's very important that ministers of education and responsible of education in our Arab countries to encourage, to promote, and to maybe to adopt or make national strategies for the for OER, because there is a lot of benefit for the country. And when there is a national strategy and a national project and a national repository of OER, so the responsible of the national repository can make conditions and can review the quality before even host this OER. So this is the two levels, and I think it's very important to encourage Arab countries to make and to build their national strategies, and this is a common project with UNESCO. We are working on this project, and mainly in the next 2 years, we have a big program to train responsible of education in Arab countries to build national strategies in OER. Also, just for your information, in 2017, there is the World Congress of OER. So now UNESCO with Commonwealth and with many stakeholders are working to prepare, and in the near future, it will be organized many regional meetings to prepare the World Congress of OER, and maybe many other issues and many other aspects will be adopted and defined. I think it's in the declaration of 2012 and UNESCO Paris. So the importance of this declaration is the metadata. Because before, there is no standards.
Sure, there are.
Yeah. But after this, and the problem, we can create, can produce OER, but this OER is not indexable, and we cannot find them easily in the web. So to use this metadata and this technical aspects, this is very important. And maybe on the World Congress next year, maybe new definition, new standards, new technical aspects will be introduced and will be adopted by the international community. And thank you very much.
Right. Of course. So there are different ways of looking at openness with respect to open learning resources, as Mohamed Jemni just said. Let me begin this way. There's a traditional distinction that is drawn, and it's drawn in the area of open source or free software, and they talk about, and now this is a North American context, so they talk about free as in beer, and, which is kind of funny because there's no such thing as free beer, but free as in not having to pay, right? And free as in freedom, but what that means is the ability to use the resource as you wish. So it's a bit of a producer-centric point of view. But the idea is the free as in no cost, means typically, not always, but typically that there is no price attached to accessing the resource by students. Now, of course, they still have to be paid for somehow because they don't typically emerge from nothingness, which is where we get our national programs from. But the idea is there's no cost barrier preventing the individual student from accessing it. The free as in freedom part is, what limitations are there on them in their use of the resource after they have accessed it? And there are different kinds of uses. In software, these are summarized as 4 or sometimes 5 R's. But the idea is it's the freedom to read the resource, the freedom to reproduce the resource, the freedom to modify or alter the resource, and the freedom to share the resource. Now, there are different ways of expressing this, but you get the idea, right? You have the thing in your hand, you can use it, alter it, give it to some, here you go, give it to someone else, right? No limitations on that. The Creative Commons licenses impose some restrictions. And you saw the chart that Muhammad showed earlier. For example, a Creative Commons non-commercial license will require that the resource be free of charge and no cost be attached to it. I believe that that is more free. But the chart that you showed and many other people think that that's less free because it's a restriction on what you can do with it. There's also a no derivatives kind of license. I want to add a third kind of open to this list. So we have open as in the sense of free, as in free beer, no charge. Open as in the sense of free, as in the sense of freedom. You can do what you want with it. There's a third type of open, which is open as in door, an open door. And this was the original meaning of open when it was used by the open university, where there were no barriers to getting into the university. There were no academic requirements. You didn't have to fill out, you know, a test or qualify. Anyone who wanted to take a course could take a course. When I worked with Athabasca University, that was the same condition as well. It was called Canada's Open University. And anyone, I had a first-year logic course. Anyone who wanted to sign up for that course and take it could take it. Now, they did not always succeed, but they could. Now, there's related to that is open as in door, openness of the marketplace itself. And here I think I have a disagreement with Muhammad, because he talked about there being a limited supply of learning resources, these limited supply of open educational resources that are vetted and reviewed before they can be used. And that was the Merleau model. Now, that's directly contradictory to the model that I talked about, where anyone can create a learning resource. And you might say, well, what about quality, right? Well, if we're in a provider model where publishers create resources and students consume them, then that's a major problem. But we're in the internet, and the network itself helps us understand what a quality resource is. As someone actually said, right? If it's a quality resource, people will use it. If people use it, then it's a quality resource. That's the definition, right? There's always this attempt to define quality in terms of some set of criteria, objectively, but as Wittgenstein would say, it's in the actual use that we see whether something is quality or not. So the method that I adopted in the MOOC was that anybody can create a learning resource. Anyone can create an open educational resource. I've created thousands of them. None of them are, well, a few of them, but mostly they're not reviewed. The only reason people know their quality is because other people use them, they share them, they pass them on to other people, and they get used to help their education. So different approaches, and these are approaches that you have to consider and choose, right? Different approaches to learning to open educational resources. Are they things that are created only by educators and must have certain formal or objective qualities? Or are they things that anyone can produce in an open marketplace and share as they wish? And that's up to you.
Stephen, I am not in disagreement with you. When I talk about the reviewing and the national repository, I want to say that the feasibility, the theoretical feasibility, because as I mentioned at the beginning, no one can omit someone to produce OER, but the feasibility. Because this is to answer the question of the feasibility of making control only, and this is in theoretical way, because for individual initiative we cannot avoid, and we cannot, so the only criteria of success is the use and the quality and adaptation of people. However, when we have a national, theoretically we can, when we have a national initiative, theoretically we have the possibility to introduce, but in practice, it's not feasible, because it's in contradiction with the openness direction and with the openness paradigm. This is what I want, and this is to answer your question. Thank you.
One more thing.
Please.
Okay, sorry. I just wanted to mention as well, because you talked about the discoverability and the standards of learning resources. And there are standards that exist. They derive from learning object metadata. And today, the current standard probably would be the Learning Resource Metadata Initiative, or LRMI. There are various standards that are in use, and they're evolving. And what we've seen, and we'll see more over time, that as part of these resource descriptions, we're also able to include what might be called evaluative metadata, or I call it third-party metadata, which is ratings, reviews, scores, approvals, sign-offs, etc., so that you have a resource. It might be reviewed by any number of different agencies. It might be reviewed by any number of different users, and that forms part of the metadata of the resource. And we're seeing more and more effort in that direction as well.
Dr. Baru?
Yeah, well, I'm not on the panel, but just I'll be talking tomorrow, but not about OER. But one thing, you know, I'd like to say is that I've been working with OER and open education resources for the past 3 years now at Notre Dame University. And we had a model, and what we did is, actually I got my experience by spending 3 weeks in the United States with Alexo. You know, they have this agreement with Alexo and United, you know, State Department. But you are most welcome, and we're going to have a website, you know, for Lebanon and for maybe the Arab countries, you know, about different initiatives happening in this area. But you're welcome tonight, you know, I'll be, you know, coming to dinner or tomorrow, all day long, you know, if, you know, somebody's interested, I'm ready and willing to share our experience at Notre Dame University, what we have done, you know, in this regard. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions or comments?
And I think now it's late, but I just want to launch this idea for the tomorrow's discussion, because we should end up the day with some policy recommendations, and between what ministries and higher education institutions should take into account so that they can work into the, in this new environment, they take advantage of these new opportunities. And I think this is one crucial kind of issue we have to consider, again, taking into account the context, yeah? Because the context is a little bit different, and there are some limitations with regard to how these open education resources can be used in different education levels. So I think this is brainstorming for all of us to think about the opportunities, but also the challenges and the limitations, and to tackle them tomorrow when we discuss the different recommendations. Because, for instance, if I know the ministries very well in the region, and I know that they are very keen to keep their quality control of learning resources, and it's legitimate. Yeah? I mean, we have to see how then these two conditions or these two things can live together. Yeah? The idea of open resources that could enrich learning and could enhance access, but also the search or the quest for quality and for some kind of very tough approach to quality and to this monitoring and evaluation of what is on the market, you know, for education.
Dr. Kara?
Yes, in this regard, I'd like to recommend one thing regarding the cost of production of open resources. You know, somebody has to pay for it. And if we are in this region to create content relevant to our region, relevant to the Arabic language, relevant to our culture, then we need support for that. And probably one of the recommendations would be to probably either encourage government or donors or international organizations to launch projects to create content, educational open content for the region. I know there are thousands of contents available in English and French and sciences and technology, but not relevant to our region. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yes. I have a question, please. If we talk about quality assurance, we have an agency for quality assurance. If we talk about national qualification framework, we need to have a body. Nowadays, we will have a lot of OERs on the web. Then, do we have some international standardization or bodies to validate OERs?
Do you think anybody on the panel can answer this, or maybe members of the
audience?
No.
No?
I'm not sure we want that. In the spirit of openness.
This is in contradiction. The control, this is in contradiction with the OER paradigm.
No, not control. I need only to validate the only criteria. I use the OER and
no, no, no. The only criteria, if you find this OER bad, you don't use it. This is the only criteria.
What's bad? Is the question.
In your term, in your regard, in your consideration, if someone of other one find this OER, the same OER that you judge it not good, someone judge it good, he can use it. This is the openness.
Yes, but I am talking, for example, on physics law and other things. Not only good or not good, true or not true.
This is the internet, this is the web. Well, you cannot, for example, in the web, you cannot forbid someone to publish something in the web.
But I think
the web is open. It's the same for educational content.
It's the role of the election, for example, for other countries to think about this, how we can...
We haven't control on the web and on the net.
Not control, validation. Recommendation.
Well, you know, since we work in the same institution, that this issue of quality and quality assurance is big, is thorny, and it's very difficult to structure as a process, right? You're assuring the quality of an object, or maybe it's a process, or maybe it's an experience. And so it seems like we need to be very, very careful about generalizing and maybe even taking a standards-based approach to quality or quality assurance. In one context, peer review might be very valid in terms of, you know, if you believe the comprehensiveness of you know, the subject matter is important for a given resource, then you might be. We struggle with this at NBU, you know this, Pierre, but why are we using this resource and not another resource in the piloting that we're going to be talking about tomorrow with Dr. Badruddin Kamal when he gets here. But it seems rather complicated, but we go back to this issue of the spirit of openness, I guess, that, you know, how do we reconcile that with the need for structure? And I think we only have 5 minutes left, and then we have to go. Yeah, the buses are here, so.
I think, Muhammad, I think something very important.
Yeah. Well, inevitably, of course, it's going to lead to a...
Now we get going with 5 minutes left.
With 5 minutes left.
I think, Dr. Pierre, something very important is...
The microphone, please.
Yeah. Something very important is training. Training teacher to produce a high quality of OER. This is what we should do, and nothing else. When we train teacher, when give them, this is the methodology, this is methods, this is tools, this is the how you can make a good OER, useful OER, and after this, we give them the freedom to produce.
I think we have time for one last question or comment.
We start the question as a comment, you know, to what Professor Muhammad is saying. This is, you know, actually, I wish, you know, I could present my model, you know, what we have done. But one of the things we've been doing for the past 2 years now is just training and training and training. And actually, this semester, we have one of our students, instead, she asked about the K-12 issue. One master's student, he's doing his master's degree, his thesis on the open education resources. And what I'm doing with him, I'm his advisor, along with Dr. Kamal Obshid, who's not here anymore, that what he's doing is he's aligning the Lebanese curriculum. He's taking, he's a physics teacher. And what he's doing is, you know, he teaches physics, using OER to align those resources to the Lebanese curriculum, and then we're going to have a model for the K-12 issue. So, well, I wish, you know, I could discuss this in more details, but, you know, that's okay. We can brainstorm, you know, tomorrow maybe. Thank you very much, Dr. Abdelmour.
Thank you. I think we have one last comment.
It's actually more of a comment rather than a question. I think nobody's going to doubt the benefit that MOOCs and OER bring and all this. So I think that nobody's questioning the many benefits that MOOCs and OER bring, probably for professionals and people in the vocational training field more than in the academic. But the forum is really about integrating ICT in higher education. And unfortunately, when we talk about higher education, there are restrictions, there are issues about what you can use and what you cannot use, and how do you map any learning resource into a curriculum, you know, how does it map into learning outcome, of course, at the program level. In many of the countries, like in the Gulf region, we have national qualification frameworks, and there are authorities to regulate that. And they're trying to encourage, I mean, the whole idea behind setting up the national qualification framework was to actually look at ways in which we can recognize informal learning into academic degrees and grad credits. But it's a challenge, and we're not there yet, and there's still this issue about, yes, there's so much on the web, and we cannot control it. But the ministries, the Commission of Accreditation's perspective is that, yes, we don't have control on what is on the web, but we have control on actually what's happening in the classrooms, in the university. And for that, you cannot just simply go and use an open educational resource on the basis that it has 200,000 people registered. It will have to actually align with standards. It will have to map into a curriculum overall. And I think that that's one of the things that we'll have to look at, because we're not talking about MOOCs and OER in general. We're talking within the context of higher education, within the context of, at the end, a student has to get a degree, any degree that is recognized preferably by the community, by the employers, and by the accreditation agencies that are regulating higher education institutions in our country. In many Arab countries, accreditation is not a luxury. Commissions of accreditation can shut down programs, they can shut down universities, as a whole. And we have several examples in the UAEs of universities that have been put under probation and that are closing down simply because the commission did not see that they were meeting that minimum level of quality. So it's a bit different from the model in the United States where you can have a university operating without actually getting accreditation. These are regulatory bodies that control everything at an institutional and a program level. And I think that one of the things we should be looking at is how can we integrate the use of OER, of MOOCs, within a pedagogical context that will lead actually to recognition of whatever a student would have taken. Because nobody wants to spend time doing a MOOCs if it's going to have no value, specifically in the context of higher education. It's different than if I'm a professional and I want to access MOOC because I want to enhance my knowledge about a subject, which is the reason why most of the people enroll into MOOCs. I personally enrolled into several MOOCs. I didn't have keen interest to complete it. I was looking for specific things. Once I got them, I've dropped out, honestly speaking, from the MOOC. So the purpose of using it here, we're talking about higher education, very specifically, and I hope that tomorrow during the quality session we'll also address in more detail this particular topic.
Thank you, and I think we're going to have to bring the discussion to an end.
Just one word. I think in the goals you don't have the national qualification program. You have degrees qualification framework and not occupation qualification framework. For this, I think it is a trigger debate. We will discuss maybe tomorrow, but thank you very much.
Thanks to the panel.
Different countries.
So, thank you so much, Mr. Trier, and our distinguished panelists. It's been a really interesting session, as all of them today. I think we can now take some rest.